threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As we move deeper into the 21st century, the geopolitical map appears to be morphing back into something that would be more familiar to people living in the 14th or 15th century. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest, who's been here several times previously, has got a new book out that we want to discuss. He is author of 10 Years of Fascination with the Mahdi's Camps, the new book, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, 10 Years of Observations on Islam. It's our honor to welcome back to the bunker Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
The difference between the two books, both books are basically compilations of columns that you've written for your website, MahdiWatch.org, over the last decade. What is the difference thematically between the two books?
Well, let me just add quickly, that's also some articles that are no longer in print from other venues like History News Network. And I did for several years have a blog at History News Network, which died a slow, painful death. Those are no longer available at all, but I managed to resurrect a lot of those for this. The difference is that 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps is exclusively about eschatology and apocalyptic, Islamic eschatology and apocalyptic. Sex, Lies, and the Caliphate, it's sort of more of a grab bag. I did try to center it around as I say in the intro to the book, around the three topics on the in the title: sex, the different aspects of Islam religiously, doctrines of Islam exemplified by things like the justified or sanctioned lying to non-Muslims called taqiyya, and then of course the key political idea that unites terrorists and a lot of non-terrorist Muslims, which is the idea of the caliphate. So the first one, again, is more about religion and eschatology. And the second one is more about, I guess you could say, politics.
And I'm still working my way through the book, but there was something that struck me in some of the early columns, columns that you wrote not long after the Islamic State declared the caliphate, which was June of 2014. It seems to me that we in the West, over the last 90 years or so, since the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, have kind of forgotten what our ancestors had to contend with. We're going back to 1,300 years plus of Islamic history. It just seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the last 90 years or so has been kind of an aberration over the last 13, 14 centuries, and that we've not had to contend with until recently a group that stepped up and said, hey, we're declaring holy war, and we're going to declare the caliphate and conquer all of you. Am I getting the right sense of things here? I mean, are we just sort of moving back in time and having to deal with now what our ancestors had to contend with for centuries?
Back to the future, Derek. No, that's exactly right. That's very sage observation. And you're one of the few people I've ever talked to that got that without me having to explain it. So, no, dead on. Basically, Islam has been around going into its 15th century now. The year 2076 will actually be the Muslim year 1500. And for almost all of that time, except really for the last century or so, you could really probably say from the fall of the Ottoman Empire, not long after World War I, up until a few years ago, Islam was a political and religious and military movement, the adherents of which made very little distinction between those three dimensions. Islam was Islam was all three at once in various guises, in its conquest, in its spread, in its institutionalization once it conquered an area. I won't even say it changed. This primary imperative of Islam to expand and to wage conquest, either military conquest or conversion or demographic conquest of non-Muslims, only sort of fell by the wayside or was subsumed for a period in the 20th century. And what happened was Islam, in its guise as purely as Islam, really got the stuffing beat out of it, particularly in political incarnations like the Ottoman Empire, by Western Christian powers. And this really didn't start happening till the 17th century, really the 18th century. The first major defeat that the Ottomans suffered at the hands of non-Muslim armies was in 1774. And ironically, it was at the hand of the Russians, which the Russian army at that time was not even the most powerful army in the world. It would have been the British or the French, of course, in 1774. Mm-hmm. But the Ottomans lost, and they continued to lose. And other Islamic states like the Mughals in India and wherever else, they always eventually lost, even if they did have some temporary success. Whereas, and this is I'm talking about like the 18th and 19th and, of course, the early 20th century. Whereas for the millennium before that, Muslim armies almost always won. And they, of course, chalked up the winning mainly to their belief in Allah and that they had the one true religion. And, you know, the Christians were still stuck in that weird, corrupted religion and so on and so forth. What happened in the 20th century after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire was that in some ways, Islam was discredited as a political movement. And the idea of jihad was somewhat discredited, at least on the state level. Some people forget, some people don't know. When World War I started in 1914, the Ottoman Empire was, of course, on the side of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Germany, the so-called Central Powers. And when the war started, they were fighting against who? Britain, France, and Russia. You know, we didn't come in until later. But the Ottoman state issued a fatwa, an Islamic ruling of jihad against the British, the French, and the Russians in 1914. So. But then the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and all the stuff that happened after World War I, which I'm sure we can talk about because it has a lot to do with ISIS. The Ottoman Empire officially was dissolved really in 1924. So for the next 50, 60 years, Islam was discredited. Other ideologies took its place. Pan-Arabism was a big one among the Arab Muslims, the idea that the Arabs should be united under one, everybody that spoke Arabic should be in one state.
Mm-hmm.
There was also socialism was tried. Socialism was tried in tandem with Pan-Arabism. The idea of of nation state loyalty was, of course, a big one. Leaders especially tried to inculcate the ideas of being you're an Egyptian or you're a Libyan or outside the Middle East, you're a Nigerian. Although these countries were by and large, Egypt is different, but Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, Libya, these countries were put together basically in more or less by European colonialists. They never actually existed in history. So you had these other ideologies. I mean, capitalism was tried to a certain extent. Even some Muslim countries like Yemen, remember Yemen was the Yemen, there was a North and South Yemen and one of them was communist. All these different ideologies were tried and none of them ever really resulted in most of the Muslim world in a successful functioning state and society. And there were a few exceptions to this. I mean, I think Turkey did a pretty good job. It may arguably be backsliding now, but for 50 or 60 years, the Turks did a pretty good job of having a normal functioning modern style state. Indonesians have done okay, Malaysia, places like that. But in the central Islamic lands, you know, the Middle East from Egypt over to Iran and from Turkey down to Yemen, there have been real problems. And what happened was, by the time there's no really good place to date this. I tend to date it at 1967. Some people would say 1979. 67, of course, being the Six Days War when all the Arab Muslim countries surrounding Israel attacked it and roundly got their behinds handed to them. 79, of course, the date of primarily the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which I realize was not Arab and it was Shia, not Sunni Muslim, but it had a great effect on Sunni Muslims. In that people saw that and a revolution centered around Islam, although from a Sunni point of view, not the right brand of Islam, could succeed in taking power. So what happened was by the time we get to the late 20th century, all these other styles of governance and modes of production And political ideology had been tried and found wanting for many, if not most, Muslims. And the idea then came back to the surface of what's called, what they call in Arabic, and what I saw these shirts when I was in Jerusalem not long ago, Islam al-Hal. Islam is the solution, right? And this, of course, is what the terrorist groups say, but a lot of groups that aren't terrorists say this. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, I would argue, is not terrorist. I mean, they're unpleasant and a threat, but not in a terrorist way. But other groups like Tablighi Jama'at, which is a big Islamic missionary group out of South Asia, the Deobandi movement in South Asia, which comes out of India and Pakistan. There's a movement by a group called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which means Party of Liberation, which specifically wants to bring back the caliphate, which I write about in the book. And I attended a couple of their conferences, believe it or not, in Chicago. There are both terrorists and non-terrorists across the Islamic world that say, for instance, I mean, the very idea of the caliphate, that's an Islamic institution, that, you know, everything would be hunky-dory if they just had a caliphate again. So what's happened is that, as you correctly, trenchantly observed, Islam was the solution, or was the system, I guess is better to say, for most Muslims, for certainly most of the first 1,300 years of Islam. In the 20th century, which is about all most Americans know, if they know that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I taught college for 7 years. Most people think the world started when they were born.
Yeah.
You know, and not just in an egotistical way, in a sort of historical way. I had a kid not long ago, talking about the Star, by the way, this is somewhat relevant, the new Star Wars movie, which of course took my kids to see. And I was talking about going to see the first one, which I guess is now number IV,
yeah,
in 1977. And I'm like, well, have you, some young kid, I don't know, teens. I said, have you seen the first one? Well, it came out before I was born. And I said, well, you know, Lincoln was before you were born, but you've heard of him, haven't you? So most people only know the 20th century and not even much of that. And certainly this is true for a lot of journalists, as we know. So, you know, they think that the 20th century, when Muslims lived under basically non-Islamic states and there was no caliphate, and Islam was usually not posited as the solution to everything, is the norm. But as you nailed down very well, for most of Islamic history, for most Muslims, because Islam has never successfully been able to separate mosque and state, Islam has always been the solution and the preferred system. And that's, and what basically what we're getting now is basically a return to the normalcy of most of Islamic history.
So what was it about the political aftermath of World War I, which, you know, for even those of us who are somewhat familiar with history, we tend to think about the European implications and the fact that the aftermath of World War I laid the groundwork for World War II. One could argue that there really was just one long war that never really ended. Right. But how did the aftermath of World War I and the division of the Middle East by the European powers set the stage for where we are today with the Muslim political movements?
Yeah, I mean, I used to say when I taught Middle East history for 7 years at college, and I just told someone this the other day, we were talking about this, because World War II happened, chronologically in time closer to us, everyone automatically assumes it's more important in all historical aspects. And with European history, it probably is. Okay. But with the Middle East, the unresolved issues that still bedevil the region, that are still exploited for good and for bad, mostly for bad, by groups like ISIS, are all from World War I. So there's a couple things. And again, it's a mix of the political and the religious, because it's really almost impossible to separate the two in Islam. The Ottoman Empire, which had been around since the late 14th century, collapsed finally at the end of World War I, or basically was collapsing and finally kicked aside by the Turks with the formation of the Turkish Republic. But the Ottomans, even in their truncated state by the time we get to World War I, because at their height they had ruled all the way across North Africa, up into southeastern Europe and all the way down to Yemen. By the time you get to World War I, they don't rule that much, but basically they rule what is now Turkey, some of what is now like Bulgaria and such, and then they ruled much of what is now the Arab Middle East. After the Ottomans collapsed, well, I should say that before the Ottomans even collapsed, but at the end of World War I in 1918, the Ottomans being on the losing side, They had to give up all of their non-Turkish speaking territory, most of their non-Turkish speaking territory, to the control of the British and the French under the League of Nations, where we didn't have a UN yet. We had that thing called the League of Nations. And the British and the French were given control of the Arab, what had been the Arab portions of the Ottoman Empire by the UN under something called the Mandate System. The idea being that these people, you know, they were too primitive and not ready to rule themselves yet. So the British and the French would colonialize them and help them learn how to do that. Yes. So, and this, there were several diplomatic agreements that led to this. The Treaty of Paris, of course, at the end of World War I, but the specific treaty between the British and the French, the specific agreement, was called Sykes-Picot. And so they, the British and the French set up the mandate system, and they took, the British took over what is now Jordan, which was called Transjordan, and which also included Jerusalem and environs, what would later become Israel and the Palestinian territories. The British also got Iraq, or created Iraq, because there had never been a country called Jordan or Iraq. Of course, Transjordan simply means what? It's on both sides of the Jordan River. That's all that thing means. Iraq had never been a country. There's never a country in Arab Islamic history called Iraq.
No, I think
Iraq, Iraq meant the area between and around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
Yeah, just as an aside, I just think it's really interesting when you go back into biblical history and you read that Nimrod began his kingdom at the ancient city of Uruk. And essentially what they did was they named the country after Nimrod's kingdom.
In a sense, yeah, that's right. That's right. Although, you know, it's interesting how that poor man's name became, you know, a name for someone that's not very intelligent.
Yes.
And then, of course, the French got what would be Syria and Lebanon because of the substantial population of Catholics there. Again, there was never a Syria on a map. Syria, what is now Syria and Iraq, were basically different vilayets, provinces of the Ottoman Empire. So the British got the British and the French got these areas, and you know all these machinations were going on with the British. The British, of course, had been involved, as we know from the movie Lawrence of Arabia. The British had been involved in World War I in helping some of the Arabs fight a guerrilla war against the Ottomans, and the British were being helped in that and being and backing on sort of, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours relationship with Sharif Hussein of Mecca, who had been the Ottoman appointed Arab ruler of Mecca. And it was and he's the one that was hoping to become like sort of the new caliph after the Ottoman Empire collapsed. Now, that didn't pan out because, of course, his people wind up losing to who? The House of Saud, the Saudis. And then, but as sort of a concession prize, the British took Sharif Hussein's sons and put one of them on the throne of the newly created country of Iraq and one of them on the throne of the newly created country of Jordan or Transjordan and so on and so forth. But anyway, so this was all, so basically when ISIS, when they created their state, you know, 18 months ago or whatever it was, they made a great deal, and I talk about this in the book, they made a great deal of the point that they're going out and literally erasing Sykes-Picot, you know, the borders, because they're saying there should not be a Syria and Iraq. It should be – it's sort of a renewal of the pan-Arab idea overlaid a great deal with more of a pan-Islamic idea. You know, there should not be – the nation states that divide the Muslims, and particularly the Arab Muslims, are artificial – divisions created by colonial powers. And, you know, one reason why this has resonance with people is it's not totally untrue. It's not totally untrue. So that's a big part of what's going on with that. The other part of it, of course, is that the last legitimately accepted caliph, the last caliphate, was that of the Ottomans. And the and ISIS, of course, has proclaimed that it it is restoring the caliphate. You know, of course, it clearly doesn't have the legitimacy, the cachet that the Ottoman caliphate had. But, you know, it's still there. So we can talk more about that. The other big thing, of course, that's not resolved from World War I is the issue of the Kurds. There are about 30 million Kurds. Kurds are, if you Google, if the listeners Google, go Google Kurdistan,
yeah,
and you'll see the map come up. There are about 30 million Kurds. The Kurds are mostly Sunni Muslim. They are sort of ethno-linguistically probably closer to Persians than they are to Arabs, because Kurdish is an Indo-European language like Persian is, whereas Arabic is not. Kurds live in northern Iraq, northeastern, I'm orienting this in my head, northeastern Syria, southeastern Turkey, and northwestern Iran. And they are, they basically got the short end of the stick at the end of World War I, because they were the only large group of stateless people that did not get a state out of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. So that's been a problem for the region ever since, because if Kurdistan were ever, all of the Kurds were to have their own state, it would take pieces away from those four countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem, of course, there would be for the Turks, because the largest concentrations of Kurds are in Turkey. And this has a great deal to do with why Turkey, which is a country that could probably in about 3 days crush ISIS, has not done anything in that direction. Because Erdogan, the Turks basically for most of the last 30 years fought a Kurdish irredentist movement that wanted to separate Turkish territory and create a Kurdistan. And Erdogan, the president of Turkey, realizes that one of the main things that keeps the Kurds preoccupied, I mean, this is just realpolitik at its best or worst, I guess, is that the Kurds have to fight ISIS. ISIS really hates the Kurds. First of all, they aren't Arabs. They are suspect Muslims, because although they are Sunni, many of the Kurds belong to Sufi orders, which you know of, maybe the listeners don't. The Sufi orders are Islamic mystical orders.
Mm-hmm.
And they generally do not get along at all with the stick-in-the-mud fundamentalists like the guys in ISIS. Many of the Kurds that aren't practicing Muslims are basically Marxists. The largest Kurdish group, the PKK, which I always forget what that stands for in Turkish, the PKK is ideologically a Marxist-Leninist outfit, which of course does not win them any favors with guys like ISIS either. So all of that is part of the mix here. These are all unresolved issues from World War I.
One of the things, and I just want to touch on Turkey and the Pan-Turkic movement for a moment, because that's something else I've been watching over the last few years, and it seems to be really driving what President Erdogan is all about, the idea of restoring the caliphate, but with the Turks in control of it, and encouraging a sort of pan-Turkic movement in as far away as Xinjiang province in China, making some very interesting overtures to Native American tribes here in the U.S., which he claims are of Turkic descent, which is, again, kind of interesting. But
I think that's a land bridge too far.
As we know, the first Turkish explorers here to the U.S. found a mosque in Cuba. But Erdogan made the comment that Turkey would be a great nation, a great power by the year 2023. And he also pointed to the year 2071 as important dates. And one of the points that you've made in both of your books, 10 Years Fascination with the Mahdi's Camps and Sex, Lies, and the Caliphate, is the tendency for Muslims to look at anniversaries of important historical dates as significant for their ambitions. 2023, of course, would be 100 years since the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. In 2071, wasn't that the 1,000 years since the victory of the, was it the Seljuk Turks?
Manzikert.
Okay, the Battle of Manzikert, right. Mm-hmm. So you've got a couple of significant events in Turkey's history that point to the ambitions, or maybe give us a clue as to what Erdogan's ambitions are. How do you see that playing out as we figure out what role Turkey plays in what's happening in the Middle East right now?
I think Erdogan is spending too much time in the hookah shop if he thinks that people in Xinjiang, China, have much in common with people in Istanbul. Okay, that's just goofy. Yes, there was this movement for a while, particularly among the Turks, not from people over in the places with Stan at the end of their name, going
Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. Yeah.
Yeah. Or is John Kerry once made up Kirakistan? There's this this pan-Turkey thing, you're right. And I think, you know, the idea, of course, was, and this was really a long, this was big before the AK party, which is the current Islamist party that rules Turkey that Erdogan is the head of, came along and got power. You know, really Turkish nationalism. And so they were trying to expand that to what, as you said, Turkic nationalism, except that there really are, it just doesn't work very well because there are a lot of differences between the peoples in Xinjiang and in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. The differences between them and the Turks of Turkey are far greater than the differences between, say, the Arabs of Morocco and the Arabs of Iraq. Okay, mm-hmm. They can't even speak to each other. The Arabs of Morocco and the Arabs of Iraq can't speak to each other. So I think that, as I said, is a bit of a stretch. I think what makes more sense is the criticism that Erdogan is neo-Ottoman, and that, you know, again, the Ottomans ruled the Middle East, all of the Middle East except for Iran, and again across North Africa and all the way down to the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula for centuries, and. You know, I don't think they're really going to be able to get Morocco back at this point or Libya or Algeria. But I think that Erdogan likes to think that the Turks, even if they don't recreate the Ottoman Empire, that the Turks could sort of influence affairs in what we used to say about the Soviets vis-a-vis the Russians, the so-called near abroad, mm-hmm. territories that used to belong to them that don't, but where they still have there's still a very real historical memory and connections in many ways in terms of families and old business routes and business connections and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think that's a bit of a stretch because again, I think that ship has sailed. The Arabs feel themselves to be quite different from the Turks as they are. What unites the Arabs and the Turks, aside from a bit of, as I said, historical memory of Ottoman rule and some nice Ottoman architecture that hopefully hasn't all been destroyed in places like Damascus and Aleppo and, and Baghdad, is that most of them are Sunni Muslim. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's enough. I think that is outweighed, I should say, by the differences between Turks and Arabs. So I think this whole Turkic thing is just really, I just don't think it's going to work. I mean, Erdogan likes to do it. I think because it looks good for some people in his party and his side of the political fence in Turkey, but I just don't think it's going anywhere.
Mm. And just saying that they're Sunni Muslim, of course, for us Westerners, kind of obscures the fact that there are different flavors of Sunni Muslim, just like there are different flavors of Baptist or Lutheran.
Yes.
You've got a couple of guys in Turkey that if we have time in this conversation or maybe in a future conversation, talk about Adnan Oktar and Fethullah Gulen and what.
I went to Turkey in 2008 and interviewed Oktar.
Oh, you did?
I did. I met with him face to face.
Well, then we must discuss this. He's a really interesting fellow. There's an expat that I got to know who's now back in Illinois, a fellow originally from the Springfield area named Cliff Garner, who taught in Turkey for several years, taught mm-hmm. English as a second language, and traveled around quite a bit and told me about this guy, Adnan Oktar, who is just... It's almost too weird to be believed when you look at video, which you can find on the internet, of his television show. He's preaching a you'd understand it better than I would. So, but just the women that he has on the show all look like Barbie dolls.
It's a cult, Derek. The Adnan Oktar, or as he goes by in Turkey, Harun Yahya.
Yeah. Okay.
Which means Aaron John. Harun and Yahya are Aaron and John in the Bible.
Interesting. Okay.
He won't come out and say this. He thinks he's the Mahdi. He lets his followers think he's the Mahdi.
Okay.
Most of his followers are very attractive blonde women who have been artificially enhanced.
Yes.
So, you know, that Tom Petty song, It's Good to Be King, mm-hmm. it's good to be Mahdi. He's an interesting fellow. I mean, as I said, I went in 2008, interviewed him in Istanbul. And in fact, in my other book, the first book, 10 Years Captivation of the Mahdi's Camps, I have that I either had the link or I have the actual interview in there. I think I have the link to it. If you get the Kindle version,
yeah,
Kindle version has the links to all this stuff. He has two drums he always beats, does Oktar. One is Mathism. Now, to be fair to this guy, I will say that he's peaceful, as near as I can ascertain. He basically says the Mahdi will peacefully convert the world when he comes. And, of course, he will restore the Ottoman Empire, speaking of which, because that was the, you know, blessed golden age of history.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mahdi is a big deal to him. The other one is he's basically an Islamic creationist. He has written tomes, or else his followers have written tomes with his name on them. I have one on my desk I'm looking at right now.
Huh.
That says that Darwinism and evolution is a tool of Iblis, Satan,
mm-hmm.
and that any good Muslim should not believe in it. So it's an interesting combo. Very interesting fellow. Again, he comes out of the same teaching. He is a disciple of the same guy who taught Fethullah Gulen.
Huh.
Yes, Gulen lives, as you know, in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Gulen was kicked out of Turkey in 1991 when it was much more nationalist and much less Islamist. Gulen and Adnan Oktar both studied the teachings of, if they personally didn't study under, a guy called Seyyed Nursi. Seyyed Nursi died in 1960. He actually was around in the in the Ottoman army before the Ottoman Empire collapsed. Nursi was a Sufi, and there's really it's never easy to explain Sufism. Sufism is Islamic mysticism. Sufis are people who have been around for about 1,200, 1,300 years. They started showing up not long after the advent of Islam. Sufis are sometimes described as charismatic. They're sort of somewhat similar to charismatic Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are. Some of them are more like, you know, monks in that they believe that following the Sharia and keeping all the dictates of Allah are necessary but not sufficient to be a good Muslim. What you need to do is have the common idea that unites most Sufis is that you have to have a personal experience of Allah. And mostly this is achieved through prayer.
Hmm.
Sufis are said to have been the ones that invented coffee. Sufis in Yemen realized that those beans that the goats were eating outside the Sufi Khanqa kept the goats jumping around all night. So they crushed the beans and made coffee. Some of them would cheat and use other drugs. And some of them used alcohol in contradiction of course, Islamic norms. But the big thing was you had to have a personal experience of God. So Sufis, there are hundreds of Sufi orders all across the Islamic world. They're not gone. They sometimes just kind of get dismissed, but no one really knows how many there are left. But I think the numbers of Sufis, in fact, the Pew in the 2012, I think it was 2012, might have been 2013 study, asked people in various countries how many of you were Sufi. And some of the countries, it's quite high percentage. That still is probably at least in the 100 million range. But they're not, you know, there's Sunni and Shia, which is, of course, the two major breakdowns of Islam. And Sufis are sometimes set up as like a third, but they're really not. You could be Sunni or Shia and be Sufi.
Hmm.
You know, it's sort of like you can be Catholic or Protestant and be charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
You can practice the mode of Sufism. It tends to predominate in Sunni Islam. Because Shia Islam is so sort of intrinsically sort of metaphysical anyway. And in fact, the Shia tended to drive out the Sufis. They don't like them very much because they're sort of like a competing brand of mysticism, if you will.
Hmm.
But there are lots of Sufis around, and a lot of them are peaceful. But on the other hand, as I talk about in my first book from back in 2005, Holiest Wars, some of the worst jihads in history were led and fought by Sufis.
Hmm.
Because they're very... For two major reasons, they're very prone to falling under the sway of a charismatic leader, especially one that proclaims himself the Mahdi, and it manages to pull off some sort of ostensible miracles. And the other reason is because they're organized, again, sort of like Catholic orders, they're organized with a head, a sheikh in charge, and basically a rank and file that once you can get them all moving in the same direction, you've got sort of ready-made army if you want to be violent.
Hmm.
So the Sufis are around. And now, Derek, I wandered down that Sufi trail, and remind me what I was trying to explain to you about.
I think we were looking at the...
Said Nursi.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. So Said Nursi was a Sufi in Turkey and very influential in the 40s and 50s, and even after he died in 1960 because his writings were so influential. And it was a brand of Sufism that, what I've read of him, very peaceful, very oriented toward education. Said that when the Mahdi comes, the Mahdi will conquer not with the sword, but by winning people over. Now, I'll take that Mahdi any day over the one that's coming with the sword and lop my head off,
yeah.
which you get in a lot of other brands of Islam. So Adnan Oktar and Fethullah Gulen, both studied this guy and are sort of offshoots of him. Gulen really emphasized the education thing. And in fact, you probably know this, a lot of people don't. The Gulen people run the largest charter school system in the world.
Yeah, including in the United States.
Well, the last I saw, they had 120. Of course, I haven't looked at it for about like 2 years, but they had at least 120 charter schools in the United States, yes. In fact, they've got one not far from me over here in North Fulton County, north of Atlanta, called the Fulton Science Academy, which I always call the Vulcan Science Academy because it sounds so much like that. But they run a lot of, in the States, they run a lot of ostensibly STEM schools. In fact, interestingly enough, two people from the Lutheran church where I attend sent a family at the Lutheran church that I attend sent two of their kids there.
Hmm.
And they said they never heard anything about religion. It was all very STEM-oriented. There have been allegations across the country, I'm sure you know, you've heard this, that they insinuate teachings about Islam into their syllabi and so on and so forth. So I don't know. In other countries, though, what I've read about them is that I think that they're much preferable. I mean, they've been setting up schools in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they teach sort of a Sufi light, peaceful version of Islam. And they say that people like ISIS and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are, you know, wrong about what they do. So I think that it's actually a pretty good thing in places like Afghanistan or Nigeria. Now, whether it's a good thing in, you know, North Georgia or Texas or wherever else is another matter, I guess. But so Adnan Oktar and Gulen both have these sort of ideas. But Gulen, I think that there are followers of Gulen who got kicked out of Turkey in 1991 because he was thought to be too religious. And now they won't let him back because although the Erdogan and other people in the ruling party in Turkey now actually seem to have either belonged to the Gulen organization or studied much of the same stuff as the Gulen people, they've had a big falling out, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
The Gulen people have been accused of trying to infiltrate into the army and the intelligence services and so on and so forth. And the AK party under Erdogan has fought back against them. And then supposedly they had embarrassing videos of senior Gulen officials doing, you know, Clintonian things. So there's a big brouhaha about that. But both of these guys, Oktar and Gulen, took from Said Nursi. But whereas Oktar went more toward the Mahdi part of it, and I think it's clear he thinks he's the Mahdi. Certainly his followers think he's the Mahdi.
Hmm.
Gulen went more toward the educational side of it, that the way you – that what's called dawah as opposed to jihad. Dawah is Islamic summons, Islamic propaganda, almost Islamic evangelism, if you will. And Gulen went toward the side of the way that we, you know, convert the world through Islam is through these schools and through the peaceful means. And so, you know, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I just think we have to, like, we as Christians have to be able to counter that. And it's certainly much preferable to people chopping our heads off.
Yeah, amen to that. And speaking of, you know, coming back to the Islamic State, we're seeing news items now where high-ranking generals in the United States military are talking about the growing threat of Islam in Libya. It seems to me that the ground is being prepared with the American public to announce that, by the way, we're now deploying troops to Libya to protect the oil fields or keep them out of ISIS hands to save the oil terminals. There are some sources that are reporting that our troops are already on the ground there, that at least special forces are there. But there are some sources from the Arabic world that claim that there are U.S., English, French, and Russian and Italian troops that are already on the ground in Libya.
Great Italian troops.
Yeah, they've got the most to be most to be concerned about. Libya's closest to them, or they're the closest ones to Libya, so it's a convenient jumping off point to southern Europe, I suppose.
Yes.
But from a political standpoint, or a perhaps geopolitical standpoint, what is the medium to long-term threat of the Islamic State to the West? Can they hold together as an entity long enough to really be a threat?
I think that would take quite a while. Look, I'm not one of these that thinks I do not think ISIS is an existential threat to the West. I think, you know, if there's an existential threat to us, it's Russia, because they still have, what, 7,000 nukes, okay? I do not think ISIS is an existential threat. It is a threat, however, and if I'm one of the persons that ISIS terrorists kill, they're certainly an existential threat to me personally. Yeah. There's no denying that. Mm-hmm. ISIS is more of a threat to the region, because they're over there with a territorial state. They are, you know, they are threatening the other states around. I one of the things I point out in I think it's the very first essay in Sex, Lies, and the Caliphate is that I think there are three goals of ISIS. And I put it Hijra, al-Haramain, and what else did I call it? Hang on, I got to look because I can't remember. Hijra, al-Haramain, and hegemony, all right? Hijra, meaning that they have a state, and this was their fiendishly brilliant maneuver that allowed them to eclipse al-Qaeda, that they declared a territorial state to which they can summon Muslims to come on Hijra. You know, again, in a recapitulation, as it were, an emulation of Muhammad's Hijra, mm-hmm. When they went from Mecca to Medina in 622 AD, when they got run out of Mecca and they went up to Medina and took over, then later came back and conquered. So, I mean, all of their Davik magazines, all of their videos, and I just finished their latest Davik magazine, number 13, the other day, which I'm writing up for History News Network over the weekend. You know, they're always trumpeting, you know, come, we need doctors, we need lawyers. Well, not lawyers. We need doctors, we need engineers, we need women to have more baby jihadists, and we need jihadists too. But come here. This is the only place where there is true Islam. So that's the Hijra part. Al-Haramain, I'll leave that for a second. Hegemony, of course, is that they want more and more power, not just in the territory they have, but they want to expand it. Where would they mainly want to expand it? I mean, there are a lot of people that think that they want to go after Israel. Now, they have put up pictures and said things about going to, taking over Al-Quds, right, Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think their more immediate goal, and that probably one of their long-term goals is to attack Israel, but their medium goal is to supplant the Saudis and take over the Arabian Peninsula. Because why? Because Mecca and Medina are there. And for any state to have any caliphal legitimacy, they'd have to rule Mecca and Medina. I mean, this is one reason the Ottomans conquered Mecca and Medina back in the 16th century. It gave them that cachet, legitimacy within Islam. So all of that's going on. I think that, you know, unlike al-Qaeda, which has been from the very early days of its creation aimed at what was called the far enemy, mainly at us, which they most successfully, of course, pulled off on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the terrorist groups in the world, to include ISIS until very recently, have gone after, been more prone to, more ideologically committed to going after the near enemy, the near enemies, I should say, I guess. You know, they wanted to go after Mubarak, and they wanted to go after al-Qaddafi, they wanted to go after al-Assad, you know, whoever, King Abdullah, you know, whoever a local ruler is. Although, you know, the inveterate propaganda of all of these groups, and not just terrorist groups, I mean, there are movements that want to get rid of these guys too, of course, obviously, with the Arab Spring and so forth. But the propaganda is always that they are propped up by us, and of course, probably by those sneaky, evil, nefarious Zionists,
yeah.
By whom, by the way, we prop up also. although they control us, it's very complex.
You have to
get inside the conspiracy theorizing. But it's a difference between going after the guys in the region and going after the backer of them. Okay, Al-Qaeda had been the only group that came after us. I mean, they would hit targets of convenience if we were there, but they didn't try to attack in New York or Washington until 9/11. ISIS had been one of the consolidate more along the lines of the near abroad enemy attackers, in that they were consolidating the territory and going after territory there. Although that changed, it seems, with the attacks in Paris. They decided to go after, in a somewhat major way, people in not the United States, but in France. Now, in here, of course, in every Dabiq magazine, every video, they call for one-off attacks, which the analysts always inaccurately call lone wolf, because they aren't lone wolf at all. Hmm. You know, the guy in Philly that shot the cop not long ago.
Right, right.
You know, the jihad, the San Bernardino jihadist, you know. Major Hassan, okay, although that he was actually before ISIS, but same idea. And as I pointed out many places, you don't have to belong to ISIS or have to have gone to one of their training camps or, you know, have signed the ISIS loyalty card from your box of Cheerios to do this. All you have to do is read the Quran and go, wait a minute, I'm supposed to behead non-Muslims on the battlefield. I'm on the battlefield because these people are not Muslims. Therefore... And then if you do see an ISIS video or pick up that nice glossy Dabiq magazine in really good English with lots of Quranic and Hadith corroboration and citations, which is very convincing, you think, well, that's the final step. I mean, they weren't radicalized by ISIS. They were radicalized by a literal understanding of Islam. And then therefore, maybe they were actuated by ISIS or actuated by Al-Qaeda. So that's how ISIS is a threat. It's a threat like that. You know, they can't get to us. If they had a nuke, they couldn't get it to us. I mean, you can't get a donkey cart across the Mediterranean and across the Atlantic. You can't get an old aging T-72 across that either. That was funny. In one of their videos a month or so ago, it was their video about conquering Rome. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw that one.
I mean, they've got like
It's like a T-54 or something. You know, it's from like the... It's like it's some tank that Khrushchev probably trained in.
Yeah, two generations ago.
I'm like, I mean, really, how are you getting that to Rome? I'm pretty sure even the Italians could take care of that. So ISIS, you know, ISIS is, I'm not saying ISIS is not a threat. It is. It's clearly a threat, but it's particularly a threat to the region. I don't think it's particularly a threat to us. If they, now, I will say this, if they had a nuke, they would love to use it on us. I have no doubt about that. I don't think they're going to get a nuke. I don't think even the Pakistanis are stupid enough to sell them one. But in terms of, you know, looked at it that way, and I think we should be fighting ISIS. But the main reason I think we should be fighting ISIS, Derek, is because they're slaughtering and killing people in the Middle East. What happened to the United States of America that used to care about things like that?
Yeah.
And of course, this small issue that most of the people, well, although most of the people they are killing arguably are Shia Muslims. Iran's doing something about that. A lot of people they are killing and oppressing are Christians.
Right.
And although we are a secular republic, I realize that this is still, until China passes us in a few years, this is still the largest Christian country on the face of the earth. Why the president of the largest Christian country on the face of the earth won't even admit that his own co-religionists are being persecuted and killed on a daily basis is simply beyond me.
Yeah.
At least the president of Russia will.
And that's really been almost surreal to watch Russia and Vladimir Putin step up as the defenders of Christendom. You know, after growing up in an age we were taught that Russia was run by a bunch of godless communists.
Well, it was, but he's not one of them.
Yeah.
Did you just see recently he was criticizing Lenin?
Yes, I did.
About how much harm Lenin had done to the Russian state and the Russian people.
It's almost as though we stepped into an alternate universe. There are a whole lot of things that data points we could bring in to make that case, but this is certainly one of them that, you know, Russia has replaced the United States as defenders of Christendom on the world stage.
It's amazing. I never thought I'd see it. I'm a child of the Cold War.
Yeah. Well, I know we only scratched the surface here, but in the interest of keeping the podcast to a manageable bite-sized length, we will close here. A quick question, where do people follow your work and get copies of both books, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, the new book, and the previous 10 years' fascination with the Mahdi's camps?
Those are both on Amazon. So if you just go to Amazon and put in Timothy Furnish, they'll come up and with my author page, hopefully. And then my website is, of course, MahdiWatch, MahdiWatch.org. Although I have to say I haven't been posting as much lately, but it's still there.
And one other question, which is regarding your books on the history of Middle Earth, the political and military histories of Middle Earth. When are those going to be ready? I've got people already lining up.
Manuscript is done. High Towers and Strong Places, A Political History of Middle Earth, because I don't think it's the political history of Middle Earth. It is all done. It is off to reviewers for review because that's being done with Oloris Publishing. You have to give the reviewers 90 days. I think they just got them out to the reviewers a week or two ago. So we're talking March or April. Okay. That's part of a two-volume set. That wasn't even the primary book. The primary book, which I'm writing right now, is Bright Swords and Glorious Warriors, A Military History of Middle Earth. So that's the main book. That was going to be the one book. And I had to write so much prefatory stuff about the political situation in Middle Earth from the first to the fourth age. My publisher said, hey, you need to make that a separate book.
Awesome.
That's what I did. Got some wonderful artwork by a nice Norwegian artist, and then a nice American chap's doing maps for me. Yes, you got to get the book because it's the first rendering I think anyone's ever done of a female orc.
Oh, really?
Yes, because I talk about where orcs come from.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, we're very eagerly looking forward to that. And I mentioned it to some other folks who we know are interested. So the word is beginning to spread. We're looking forward to those. We'll have you back when those are ready, if not sooner.
I'll let you know.
All right. Dr. Timothy Furnish, author of the new book, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, available on Kindle. And get the Kindle version or the e-book version because the links to the other resources that he pulls in are great, especially when he chooses to use a clip from a famous movie and links to that. That's always entertaining. So it's a good read, but very educational. Tim, very much appreciate your time.
Thank you, Derek.
We have links, and they are posted in the show notes at vftb.net. VFTB is what you call your basic acronym, View from the Bunker. vftb.net for a link to MahdiWatch.org and links to where you can find 10 Years Fascination with the Mahdi's Camps and Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate by Dr. Timothy Furnish. Appreciate his insight on this. Not only is he a scholar of Islamic world and African history, he's also got a master's in religion from Concordia Seminary and served in the U.S. military. In fact, served the 101st Airborne as an Arabic interrogator and as a chaplain, and has served as a consultant and guest lecturer for Joint Special Operations University until he kept using the J word, jihad, in conjunction with Islamic groups, which was not acceptable to the Obama administration, apparently. So, but setting that aside, his insight much appreciated because here in the West, we appear to have blinders when it comes to dealing with any group that actually tries to live out according to its faith, Islamic, Christian, Jewish, or otherwise. And that would really help explain a lot of what we're seeing from the Islamic State and other groups in the Middle East these days. If we would just take them at their word and accept that there are people out there who try to live according to the religion that they profess. And that is going to lead to perhaps another deployment of American troops, as at least a couple of American generals now saying that we need to take stronger action against the Islamic State in Libya. And it is confirmed from mainstream sources that we do have at least some special operations forces, troops on the ground in Libya, reconnoitering, trying to make contact with groups there to see who we might be able to trust, which has been a real problem for us in the Middle East because many of the groups that we thought we could trust have been less than trustworthy. And it just, which illustrates how stupid it is to drop 50 tons of ammunition in the middle of the Syrian desert and hope the good guys are the ones who pick up the pallets. Anyway, another interesting item that I picked up in the news this morning, the chief of U.S. Special Operations wrote a memo about 6 weeks ago to Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter. General Joseph Votel, who was the head of SOCOM, nominated, by the way, to take over command of CENTCOM, essentially said to the Secretary of Defense, with all due respect, Mr. Secretary, please shut up about where we're deploying our special forces. This was after the president, well, the White House anyway, spokesman for the president, and Secretary of Defense Carter publicly announced that we were deploying a couple hundred special operations troops to Iraq to help fight the Islamic State. Regardless of the fact that the prime minister of Iraq and his government in Baghdad said, we don't want you here. And the Shia militia forces in Iraq said, we'll shoot at you if you show up. Anyway, General Votel made a good point, apparently, and this was reported by Foreign Policy, a magazine that I subscribe to, that obtained a copy of the email, or the memo, rather, basically said you're going to put American troops and operations at risk if you keep publicly talking about where they're going and what they're going to be doing. Loose lips sink ships, in other words. One other item in the news, and of course, this is one that is getting a lot of attention and some spin, I would venture to say. The standoff in Oregon at the Mount Laurel National Wildlife Refuge may not be completely over yet, but the leaders of the standoff, the leaders of the militia occupation of that group, protesting the mistreatment of ranchers in Oregon, the Hammond family in particular, by the federal government, took a bloody turn earlier this week. Several members of the militia unit, Ammon Bundy, his brother Ryan, and a number of others were arrested by police. A traffic stop. They had two vehicles in this caravan on their way from the refuge to a community meeting in a nearby town. And they were stopped by police. And at this traffic stop, gunfire was exchanged. And I can't tell from the stories who fired first, how many shots were fired. I've seen some claims that as many as 100 to 120 shots were fired by police at the militiamen. One of the spokesmen for the militia, 55-year-old Lavoy Finnicum, was killed. He's a rancher from Arizona. Ryan Bundy apparently shot in the arm. But details aren't clear, and I'm not going to say that I know what was going on. There are some who claim that this was Cliven Bundy, the father of Ammon and Ryan, said that it was a cold-blooded murder. But not having been there and having to depend on media sources for information or the claims of those who have a vested interest in making the government look bad. And I'm not taking the government side here. I'm just saying I don't know what the details are. It's just sad that it went this way and that cooler heads weren't able to prevail. Now, Ammon Bundy, through his attorney, is calling on those still at the wildlife refuge to stand down, basically just go home. As of yesterday, which was Wednesday, the 27th, those at the refuge were saying they were going to stay until their demands were met, but the odds of their demands being met are slim to none, sadly. There's no question that the government has been legislating through regulation when it comes to grazing lands out in the West, and the ranchers out there have been mistreated. But taking up arms against the government well, 2 points. First, I don't see any scriptural support for it, and I know that there are those who disagree with me, but I'm sorry. I just don't see it in scripture. The Hammond family fought the government, but they did it through legal channels until their appeals were exhausted, and then the two Hammond men, and forgive me because I don't have their names in front of me at the moment, Dwight and Stephen, I believe, accepted their sentences and surrendered themselves peacefully to the authorities. That seems to me to be in line with our scriptural command to be subject to human authorities, even when those human authorities are unjust, even when they're acting in unbiblical ways. I don't see any exemptions in scripture. The exemptions come when you're asked to do something that contradicts clear teachings of the Bible, like don't preach the name of Jesus. Don't teach Christ and him crucified. Or something of that ilk. You know, worship a false god. You know, Daniel resisted authority when he was told he had to stop praying to Yahweh and when he had to worship an idol. Peter and John got themselves into trouble when they refused to stop preaching in the name of Jesus. But when soldiers came to arrest Jesus and Peter took out his sword, Jesus told him to put it away, and he healed the ear of the high priest's servant. So it is a tragedy that Mr. Finnicum has been killed. And it is tragic that that was not avoided. But sadly, from the moment that the militia group decided to occupy the wildlife refuge, that was always a possibility. And certainly, no doubt, the men who did that understood that when they took over the wildlife refuge, that was something that might happen. But sad to see it happen, and again, sad that our federal government is continuing to overreach its constitutional authority. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we'll talk about the overreach of our courts in drawing upon precedent in international court to make rulings, and also drawing upon a law that was enacted in the 1790s, something called the Alien Torts Statute, to justify foreign nationals suing American citizens in American court for actions committed overseas that were not even against the law in that other nation. Dr. Scott Lively is our guest, and he will be our guest on the Sunday program, uploaded on January 31st. February 3rd, Brian Gadawa launches a new fiction series, Chronicles of the Watchers, the first entry called The Dragon King, and he is co-authoring this with Charlie Wen, who was the director of visual development, basically the guy who came up with all the visuals for most of the recent Marvel superhero movies, including Ant-Man, Thor, The Dark Realm, Avengers, Age of Ultron, and things like that. We'll talk about The Chronicles of the Watchers. I read that book in about two nights, which lately I don't often find time to do, but this book really grabbed me and engaged me. So we'll talk about the new series, and I've got a review posted on my website, derekpgilbert.com, of the Dragon King. On February 7th, Eddie Donnelly, a new guest to A View from the Bunker, talking about his novel, Doctrines of Demons, and those are what's on the schedule as of this point on A View from the Bunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.